The following talk, entitled The Esoteric Plato by Dr. Rene Weber, is presented by the Theosophical Society in America.
Well, today I will talk to you about the Esoteric Plato, and it's a vast subject, as Platonic literature is so rich and so deep, and so I will extract what seems to me most essential. Now, when somebody talks about the esoteric Plato, one qualifies Plato, doesn't he? And therefore, immediately the question comes up, the esoteric Plato as compared to whom? And the answer, of course, is the exoteric Plato. So let's get these terms somewhat cleared up. And I'm not just playing here with words, but it's part and parcel of my subject matter to make this distinction between exoteric and esoteric. Esoteric means inner, within, interior, and that's its literal meaning. And through usage and context, it has also come to mean designed for and understood by the specially initiated or belonging to the circle initiated into such teachings. So esoteric already tells us something, that a teaching that's purported to be esoteric is addressed to a specific group of people, not to the populace at large. We call these the initiated or the mysteries. They're known through history by various names. The exoteric Plato is the Plato that, if you studied him in school at all, you were taught. The exoteric Plato is a deeply respected philosopher, taught universally. There certainly cannot be a self-respecting department of philosophy that doesn't offer a course or courses on Plato. But it's a different Plato, I would suggest, from the one that I'll be discussing today. The exoteric Plato is respected because certainly even for the world at large, for the public or for the world of scholars, Plato continues throughout all these many centuries, really 25 centuries. He lived in the 4th century BC in Athens. He continues to exert a fascination and to hold a promise, if you like, for anybody who's trying to understand not only philosophy and the history of philosophy and its problems, but something about man and the cosmos. And so this Plato that, for example, my colleagues happily study and discuss is respected, acknowledged as one of the truly giant minds in the history of ideas. At the same time, an entire dimension of this person, is this figure, is ignored in academia and in general, I would say. And that's the Plato that I'm going to be dealing with today. Now, I think both exoteric and esoteric approaches to Plato would agree on one central point, that in dealing with Plato, one is dealing with fundamental problems that have never yet been outmoded or dated, even though 2,500 years separate us from the time during which Plato wrote, and that have not been solved. Because they have not been solved, one senses continuously that something remains or lies concealed under the surface that one somehow cannot quite get a hold of. And I know this is true even of the, let us say, much more empirically oriented scholars who work in Plato today and who continue to find his posing of these problems, problems regarding being, regarding knowledge, regarding the nature of the universe, the nature of man, who continue to find all of these alive, vital to their intellectual and other lives. However, it seems to me at least that these very problems that continue to exercise such a deep fascination on one trying to understand Plato cannot be really solved, nor his theories understood, without the esoteric key, which I think Plato scatters throughout his works, but one has to dig them out, and probably one has to bring to Plato something beyond a mere inquiry into the words themselves, but rather a context, which we call in Theosophy and elsewhere the whole context of esotericism, which has specific insights and doctrines and methods and premises shared to a remarkable degree throughout history by various such esoteric groups or schools. And so the Plato that you probably didn't study in school and that your teacher most likely told you to skip when reading the Republic or the Phaedrus or other works of Plato is, in method and style, the Plato who speaks in myth, in allegory, he speaks poetically, and he does not develop the same line of argument as he does in his more straightforward, stepwise, empirical, discursive writings. And it's precisely, I think, in the myths and in the allegories that the esoteric key, which unravels the exoteric aspect of Plato, is found and is buried. Now, one thing that I have always found puzzling, and so I'm still now addressing myself to Plato's method and style on the esoteric plane, if you like, I have always found it puzzling that people who are so deeply devoted to Platonic philosophy, to Platonic concepts, and who hang on every word that Plato has written. And I can tell you that if, for example, to fantasy now a little bit, a new manuscript were discovered today somewhere, buried in Athens under some ancient ruin, as there are other discoveries being made, the world of scholarship would be seething with excitement. And it would be a major event in philosophy and in the history of ideas. So this ought to tell us that the attachment to Plato is enormous, even among people who are not theosophically oriented. Okay, now if that is the case, I have always been puzzled by the seeming contradiction, namely in the following respect. People who hang on Plato's every word nonetheless ignore what Plato himself says about what he says completely. And so when Plato tells us repeatedly throughout his dialogues and in the seventh letter, look, what I have to say is sacred. Some of these teachings are ancient and sacred doctrines. These are his own words. They cannot be fully understood. I cannot tell you exactly what the concepts which I'm trying to get across are like. I can give you only an approximate picture, a likeness, he says, of what things really are about. Something like the truth is what I'm going to give you, he says that. And furthermore, he says, these were taught to me by initiates. And he uses the word initiate, and he uses the word sacred rites, and he uses the word the mysteries, which refers to the Eleusinian mysteries of ancient Greece, which were religious and mystical and experiential in character. And the many things he says about divinities, the gods in plural, the gods that are everywhere in the universe and have had a hand in its framing and continue to have a hand in sustaining us and have laid down the order and the symmetry and the harmony and the beauty and all that. All of these, which are so central to Plato and which he himself says are important, are usually ignored because people are a little bit uncomfortable with them. They don't quite know what to do with them and where, and how, into what to fit them. And so, without further ado now, having talked just a little bit about background and method and style, I'd like to get to the content of Plato's own ideas. So, what did Plato say? What did he teach? Why is it esoteric? And how can we unravel it? And to do that, I'll go very quickly through some of his ideas, and then very slowly through at least five of his myths, allegories, or parables, and try to extract doctrines from these. One further thing I think I should share with you before I begin on these doctrines, I like especially the quotation from The Secret Doctrine of Madame Blavatsky, who comes right out and says that Plato was an initiate. Now, I think that's perhaps one additional reason for taking him seriously. She says, for over 22 centuries, everyone who has read Plato has been aware that, like most of the other Greek philosophers, I suppose she means Pythagoras and very likely Empedocles, of note, he had been initiated, that therefore being tied down by the Sedalian oath, he could speak of certain things only in veiled allegories. Every time the subject touches the greater secrets of Oriental wisdom, the cosmogony of the universe, or the ideal pre-existing world, Plato shrouds his philosophy in the profoundest darkness. And elsewhere she says, and now she gets to the content, the Pythagorean doctrine that God is the universal mind diffused through all things and the dogma of the soul's immortality are the leading features in these apparently incongruous teachings. His piety, she's talking about Plato, and the great veneration he felt for the mysteries are sufficient warrant that Plato would not allow his indiscretion to get the better of that deep sense of responsibility which is felt by every adept. Unquote. That's in volume one of The Secret Doctrine. All right, what are some of the esoteric doctrines of Plato, just in brief review? I think we can divide them broadly into two categories, those dealing with the cosmos as a whole and those dealing with man, who is the microcosm and made to mirror the larger cosmos. As for the cosmos, perhaps the most important Platonic teaching is that it is divine in origin and divinely made. And I think Plato, by the way, has a very charming view in the Timaeus, which is his large treatise on the creation of the world and on man, and it's a kind of treatise on esoteric medicine and mathematics, all compounded. It's a puzzling and intriguing dialogue and still not fully understood by most people. But in there he says, without any apology, that's what I think is rather charming for someone who in general is so extremely careful, analytic, stepwise, trying to show every step of every argument to convince the reader, to reason it out, to grasp it on his own, not to have faith in something. After all, Plato is a Greek, and the Greek mind, as you know, is perhaps synonymous with the ideal of rationality. But in the Timaeus, where Plato allows himself much greater freedom and doesn't basically present arguments, he simply presents his views. He says, without feeling in the least bit embarrassed, quote, about the divine origin of man and the universe, quote, to know or tell the origin of the other divinities is beyond us, and we must accept the tradition of the men of old time who affirm themselves to be the offspring of the gods. That is what they say, and they must surely know their own ancestors, unquote. Now, I think that's charming. He says, after all, they say that that's who their parents are, and they ought to know that they're born of divine beings. All right, so the universe is divine and divinely made, and basically it's abstract. Plato affirms over and over in everything he's ever written the reality of the non-material as alone capable of explaining everything, anything, and most of all, the visible material world in which we live and which we apprehend through our senses. In itself, this cannot be understood or explained. It can certainly be described, but not explained. And Plato makes that distinction in the Phaedo between description and explanation. And so, without invoking the basic underlying cause that generated this visible, tangible world, we cannot understand. And for Plato, the basic underlying cause is non-material, it's ideal, its essence can be apprehended through great difficulty and labor, through the mind, through the intuition, we would say, with the mind's eye, if you like. And this essential fundamental reality, Plato calls form, with a capital F, or idea, with a capital I. And I think you might find interesting the meaning, the origin of the word idea. It's very different from what we think it to be today. Idea comes from the Greek word idein, I-D-E-I-N, and it means to see, to apprehend or to see. Hence, we're put on notice immediately that the fundamental reality underlying everything and which alone can explain anything is something that can and must be apprehended. It's an experiential connection to man and not merely an analytic or verbal one. I thought it might be interesting to you to invoke a similar strand of thought from another esoteric tradition, and I'm quoting The Secret Doctrine. And Madame Blavatsky writes, quote, "The divine thought does not imply the idea of a divine thinker, but rather the universe itself as that thought, reflected in a manifested cause." This is very Platonic. This is exactly what Plato's ontology, his science of being, claims. All right, these forms, essences, ideas, or archetypes, then, are capable of being apprehended, capable of being seen, and that has immediate implications for man. If they're capable of being seen, that makes, on one level, of man a seer, someone who is capable of seeing. And I would argue, without fearing exaggeration, that the Platonic dialogues, on one level, because they function on various levels, all move one to an exhortation, an urging, to so structure one's life that this seeing of the forms becomes possible. Now, that brings me immediately to the notion of man. A man, says Plato, far from being a bundle of drives or sense perceptions, this thesis that today behavioristic psychology, people like Skinner and others, are propounding, and which had its analogues exactly in Plato's own day, the Sophists, for example, whom he fought in his writings, in his teachings, propounded essentially the same thing. They were materialists. Plato obviously took exception to this, and man, far from being a bundle of drives and sense perceptions to be pushed and pulled by stimulus and response and the carrot and the stick and all that, is a divine being in his essence. This does not mean that he isn't also an empirical animal who lives in the world of space and time and uses his senses. Surely it means that as well. But for Plato, that is but the beginning, and surely not the end. And he shows us in the symposium, to which I'll presently turn, that human beings, being basically compounded of a spark of the divine, cannot be happy crushing or stamping out or burying that spark, that their lives will never strike them as fulfilled unless they mobilize, if you will, or develop that spark and develop it to its maximum, which in which case they can indeed apprehend the divine, Plato uses a very beautiful phrase, they can enter into union with the form, an experience that we would designate as mystical, obviously, a oneness. And so man then is descendant from the gods. He has a spark of the divine in him. This is the most important thing about him. Plato, like every great mind, is a realist on one level. He's quite aware of the fact that we are embedded in a world of struggle, of pain, often of confusion. And it's not, therefore, that he deliberately leaves out any of that. He deals with it. He talks about it in almost all his dialogues under the topic of the appetites, the desires, the volitions of man, and comes down firmly, if you like, nonetheless, on the side of this concept that I've indicated, that living without honoring, if you like, let alone developing, this divine spark can never bring happiness for man, and that, in fact, he puts it far more strongly than I'm putting it in the symposium, in his wonderful allegory of the ladder of love, a kind of metaphor. Plato shows that what we seek, even in falling in love with somebody else, is not merely that person. That may be a beginning, but it's not an end point. What we seek is the whole universe. And it is, as it were, to fall in love with the universe as a whole. I'll come back to that. Insofar as man is concerned, and that connects to this notion of the divine spark within us, Plato affirms a doctrine of recollection, as it's known. The doctrine of recollection, or of anamnesis, simply says that, well, let's say it tackles the problem that psychologists and philosophers would call the problem of learning, learning theory. Just as it was a puzzlement in Plato's day, it's still a puzzlement today. I can assure you that no one can give a proper account to this day of how learning proceeds. We really don't know. And Plato has a hypothesis. And for him, it's a reality. But let's call it, for the sake of being open-minded at this moment, a hypothesis. And the hypothesis is as follows. Well, he poses a dilemma, a paradox, in the Meno, which is still viable. I read a very interesting article recently from Journal of Psychology, by a psychologist, on Plato's theory of learning. And he says, of all the theories of learning around today, that's the one that still makes the most sense. The paradox posed in the Meno goes as follows. How, says Plato, can we really learn anything if we don't know a thing about the subject we're seeking to learn, to understand? Then, amidst the myriad ideas which we will encounter, how is it that we'll know, recognize, or know the answer to the problem we've been seeking if we literally know nothing about the answer? In other words, how can we, let's say we have a problem, we want to understand something, we're looking for an answer. There are literally billions and billions of possible answers to that problem. Let's say a problem in geometry, the aha phenomenon when you finally figured out the angles or how to bisect something. If we knew nothing whatsoever about the answer, we wouldn't know the answer when we'd found it. That's one half of the paradox. The other half of the paradox, says Plato, if we already know the answer, we're not going to look for it because then we have it. Therefore, he suggests that learning is a halfway house. In learning, we both know and we don't know. We know in a sense that's implicit. And we don't know in the sense that it's not at our fingertips, it's not present to us, it's not explicit, it's not conscious, if you like. And so this forms part of Plato's doctrine of recollection, which he propounds in the Phaedo, in the Meno, in the Symposium, in the Phaedrus, in the Republic, virtually everywhere, in other words, in his major works of his middle period. And this doctrine says the reason that we are in this halfway position, this halfway house, is that we have lived before. He says it without any shame. We have lived before. We have encountered the universal essences which are involved in all reasoning, in all learning. And therefore, learning, and hence knowledge, is but a, not just a collecting, that would be Skinner and David Hume, the empirical tradition. It's not a collecting, it's a recollecting. Re means again, doesn't it? Therefore, all knowledge, and certainly knowledge of what we call abstract universals or essences, like circularity, circles in geometry, straight lines, moral qualities, justice, equality, goodness, all of these things we have met elsewhere in a prior, we would call it today, state of consciousness, domain. Plato said in a prior existence, on a prior level of being, and I'll come to that by and by, in the intelligible world, this disembodied world of essences where true being resides, and which everyone who is incarnate, he says in the Phaedrus, in human form has seen. If we had not, all of us, at one time or other, dimly or clearly, for a short time or a long time, glimpsed the forms, the ideal essences, we would not be in a human body at all. That's his position, period. And that means, you see, that he's very hopeful for the learning capacity, the insight making capacity of man. He puts, as it were, he gives us tremendous, what shall I say, trust. He honors, if you like, the fact that in every human being now alive, there is the potential philosopher. And the philosopher is a lover of wisdom. That's Plato's definition. Now, the doctrine of recollection is not merely one possible hypothesis for learning theory, because tied to it, part and parcel of it, if we've lived before, if we've seen these ultimates in a prior existence and simply recognize them again on appropriate stimulation, when we come back to life again in the... So on, that implies a doctrine of reincarnation. Plato is challenged to prove this in the Phaedo, where one of his discussants, who is a Pythagorean, says, by the name of Chibis, yes, we may have lived again. You've convinced me of that. And Plato has gone through a great many steps in his argument to document this for Simmias and Chibis. But, says Chibis, how do I know that having lived before, I shall live again? How do I know that this goes on eternally? And Plato adduces his final argument in the Phaedo. It's too long to reproduce here, but the gist of it is, it has to be that way, because what you mean by you, he addresses Chibis, is precisely something that's uncompounded. It's not made up of parts. It's not put together. It's like a point without dimension. Therefore, it's incapable of being pulled apart, of being assailed by anything, by any force, by time, by anything in space. It isn't spatial to begin with. It's not that kind of entity, says Plato. That's what the soul is. That's what the enduring part of human reality is. And being made in such a manner, it can't be dissolved. And that is, so that and other arguments Plato adduces to buttress his theory of reincarnation. Tied to reincarnation, and again, in I think what Jerry said earlier is exactly correct. Theosophists are thought to be rooted only in Hindu and Buddhist philosophy, but that isn't the case. I think there's a strong Platonic and Pythagorean element as well in this. And so just as in Eastern doctrines, you have recollection, reincarnation, all tied up with karma, the doctrine of action and reaction, this moral Newtonianism in the universe that says you're responsible. Things have consequences. They don't just go away. They're there. They're recorded. And anything we do bears fruit. And that's what morality, justice on a cosmic level is all about. So does Plato hold precisely to this view. He doesn't use the word karma, and I don't think we should fault him for that, because he's not writing in Sanskrit, he's writing in Greek. He says the cycle of necessity. Now, if you look at the 10th book of the Republic, the myth of Ur, for example, which I'll try to come back to, yes, there's time, and some of his other works, you'll find that the cycle of necessity occupies the same place, it has the same function as karma does in Eastern systems, in Plato's system. In the Republic, for example, the whole dialogue, you know, the Republic is, with one exception, the Laws, the longest of Plato's dialogues. It's composed of 10, we call them books, but they're really chapters. It's thought to be a treatise on political and social structure. I don't hold with that view. I think on one level, perhaps superficially, it is that. But it's basically, I believe, an esoteric document, a blueprint for a yogic society. What would a society look like that would allow its citizens development along yogic lines in order, ultimately, and the highlight of the Republic is Book 7, the allegory of the cave, in order ultimately to enter into union with the form, with the absolute. That's what I think the Republic is about. But at any rate, in the Republic, in one of the places, in the beginning, somebody proposes the inquiry about justice and asks what justice is and challenges. He's a hard-boiled cynic who first proposes this argument. And he says, people are just only for fear of punishment. If they could get away with it, they'd get away with anything, including murder. So it's the kind of cynical argument. And he sort of dumps that argument into the lap of Plato, and Plato has to spend 10 books to refute it. It's not an easy task. Plato, arguing that viewpoint, even making life hard for himself, if you will, says, look, suppose somebody gave you a ring called the Ring of Gyges in the Republic that made you invisible. What would you do? Would you live your life differently from the way you live it now? That ring would confer the property of invisibility on the wearer, which would mean literally you could get away with murder, if that's your hang-up, if that's your desire in life. And so this, against this testing stone, if you like, Plato asks us to measure the reality of our own values. And he argues, and it's a very long, long road he takes, that justice is certainly not obeying rules or laws. It's a way of being. It's a state of consciousness. It's a whole way of life. And someone deeply imbued with it as an ideal or as a value lives in that way, whether he is wearing the Ring of Gyges or not. And at the very end, literally in the last book of the Republic, Plato pulls it all together. He's just shown us that justice does not end with a society, nor does it begin with a society. It's not something merely local nor arbitrary, although certainly given societies reflect the ideal of justice. But for Plato, justice is a cosmic force. Its laws work upon man whether he is aware of them or not, whether he obeys them or not. And the Ring of Gyges is shown by implication in the Republic to be a foolish fabrication of an immature daydreaming mind. And so in the end, and this is one of the statements that spells out karma in the Republic, Plato says, quote, "In the first place, the nature both of the just and unjust is truly known to the gods or to the divinities." Now that, of course, makes one think immediately of the idea of karma, which both Eastern philosophy and theosophy hold to, that you cannot ever escape the consequences of any action because everything we do bears fruit and is related to something else. In the Myth of Ur, in the 10th book of the Republic, Plato has gives us a view of the afterworld in which the soul is judged for its deeds because, as he says over and over again, the soul is really the garment which endures, the outer garment, the body, he calls it sometimes an oyster shell, we cast off. And death is the separation of the soul from the body and vice versa, the body from the soul. But this inner garment always clings to us. And when man experiences the separation from his material frame, what he carries with him, it's probably a bad choice of words, what remains and what he is ultimately, is this inner, if you like, imprint, this spark, which records in ways that surely Plato doesn't spell out and that no one has understood exactly, records and registers. Registers is perhaps better. Everything we've lived and said and done, and especially, Plato says, our nature and our nurture, our moral and our intellectual qualities. Again, it makes me think of this recurrent thread in the esoteric tradition. And so the Myth of Ur in the Republic might well be parallel, is parallel to, might well be explicated in terms of something that Madame Blavatsky writes in The Secret Doctrine. She talks really of space, which is also a major category in Plato. We call it akasha. Plato calls it space and the divine demiurge who works within it. But to get back to this karmic idea, she says, quote, "The Lipika," that means scribes, "are mystically these divine beings connected with karma, for they are the recorders or analysts who impress on the invisible tablets of the astrolite, that great picture gallery of eternity, a faithful record of everything in the universe," unquote. Now, this is a very complex idea, and I, for one, was spellbound to discover a parallel to this in Plato, because one might argue, and if you know the Republic well and look at it again, you'll see that what I'm saying holds true, that all of the Republic, how man lives, how he lives innerly, how he relates to other people, how he builds and structures an educational system and a society, and all of that, his mystical vision in the 7th book of the Republic, all of that leads up to, eventually, the continuity of life, even when man has left his body behind. And depending on what he's chosen, one kind of life or another, that of the tyrant in the Republic or that of the philosopher, because that's the contrast Plato draws. Depending on what he's chosen, a certain kind of fate awaits him when he sheds the body. And not only in that state, but it determines what will become of him when he reincarnates, which Plato quite frankly advocates in that passage. And he says, he has a very charming metaphor, and he says, all kinds of lives are paraded before the person who is about to redescend back into incarnation. They're the life of the rich man and the poor man and the scholar and the tyrant and somebody who's beautiful but poor, ugly but rich, beautiful and rich, and so on. And he gives you all the combinations. And these are paraded before you. And he says, it will take great discernment and a knowledge of who you are, what your values are, to know which life to choose. And then, in quite typical, blunt, if you like, fashion, he says, the responsibility lies with the chooser. So it's our choice, it's weaving our lives together, if you will, that leave an imprint on that subtler body, we would say in esoteric philosophy, that determines not only this life, but another life, a next life. All right? Now, several other theories, really, that I wanted to share with you in Plato. For one thing, the separation of soul and body. Now, I've touched on that. You can see that it has ramifications for Platonic views on learning, on values, on ethics, but it goes beyond that. For Plato, only a person who properly has understood what philosophy is can tune in on the ultimate. So a philosophic life would, he tells us in the myth of Ur, would be the best of all possible lives for realizing what man is striving after, which is wisdom, beauty, truth, goodness, his absolutes. And so philosophy, Plato defines in a number of ways. First of all, literally, it's the love of wisdom. That's not a very astonishing definition. That's traditional and common. But then he says something else that is very astonishing. It startles you. And I can tell you, when students come to me wondering what to major in and ask me to tell them something about philosophy, I never give them Plato's second definition. Because Plato's second definition is, philosophy is the practice of the art of death and dying. Now, I'm not going to tell prospective majors that, because we wouldn't have a department left, right? And we'd all go and sell apples. So I tell them very cheerfully, philosophy is the love of wisdom. And after they sign their course cards, then we really let them know. So what does he mean by that? What is the practice of the art of death and dying? And why should that be so profound an insight as to bear the burden of his definition of philosophy? Or to put the two together, the practice of the art of death and dying is wisdom, is the love of wisdom. Why? Well, I think if you know a little bit about Plato, and if you've put together some of the threads I've been weaving, you'll see that the practice of the art of death and dying is but another way of using the word detachment. It's one of the Buddhist virtues in Buddhist philosophy. It's the central prerequisite and qualification for doing meditation in the Hindu system of yoga, Patanjali's sutras. And for Plato, the philosophic art of learning detachment, not being mired in the world of the senses or in what is obvious or in common sense naive realism, we call that in philosophy, is the beginning of that long path, arduous, long, and steep, he says in the Republic, in the Allegory of the Cave, which in esoteric philosophy we call the path, with a capital everything, T-N-P, the path. And the practice of the art of death and dying involves all of man. It's a very difficult thing to learn. Hence, philosophy is a very difficult thing to learn. It doesn't come as easily as simply memorizing what Kant said or what Pythagoras said or anything like that. For Plato, philosophy is holistic. It involves all the levels of my being, from the physical through the highest intuitive parts of myself. To start with the physical, Plato has very specific ideas as to how a philosophical life should be lived. And he says in the Republic, he is so modern, it's beautiful, really, to behold. In the Republic, he sounds like somebody who might be writing today in a New Age journal or in something ecological, because he comes out for what I would term a yogic diet. Vegetarianism is necessary to the philosophic life. And simplicity in all kinds of habits and in garments and in this and in that and so on. And he says, this is my ideal state. A state governed even by, on the physical level, these simple principles is healthy. And then his respondents say to him, what kind of a state are you giving us? That's a state for pigs, not for people. We want luxuries, we want benches, we want sauces, we want flute girls, etc. And so Plato says, all right, I gave you the best, but if you want the next best, then okay, so be it, but it won't be a healthy state. He said it'll be a state raised to its fever pitch. It'll be sick somewhat. It'll be swollen and inflamed. He uses these words. And it can never be what the simple ideal state would have been. And he ties that, again, it's so modern, ties that to the genesis of war. In our early state, he said, we didn't need grazing animals, we didn't need swine, we didn't need any of these cattle, but now we do. That means our lands are not big enough. That means we have to enlarge our borders. That means we have to have an army, which we didn't need originally, and that means we'll have to go to war. So he ties, in a way, vegetarianism to peaceful coexistences of states and meeting to expansion and militarism and power and war. All right, so on the physical level, Plato has some very specific ideas. On the emotional level, he argues over and over for balance. That's very Greek. For balance, stability, fearlessness, courage. He uses the word temperance for balance. So that's the second thing. On the intellectual level, Plato has a specific program of education. And that program of education is designed to turn the soul from the sense particular to the abstract universal essences, which the senses can not behold, but which the senses can begin to stimulate in us, as when you look at a beautiful object, you sense something that's totally captivating. And from Plato's point of view in the symposium, you really fall in love with that thing. And pursuing that thing all the way to its end, you move through increasingly universal and abstract manifestations of beauty until finally, he says, you come to the idea of beauty itself, which is a kind of beatific vision. It's an all-encompassing relationship to what you behold, no longer dualistic in nature, no longer a you and a rose, let's say, but a wholeness, entering into union with it, he calls it. On the intellectual level, at its upper reaches, beyond the realm of mathematics, which Plato felt to be excellent training for the mind in grasping unseen realities and in simplifying itself through discipline and through precision. At its upper reaches, there is something that lies even beyond mathematics, and he calls it dialectic. But for my purposes, I would equate it with any intuitive state of consciousness, such as meditation. And that state of being, that kind of knowing, quote-unquote, Plato insists, is wordless. It cannot be put into words, because words are, after all, translations, aren't they, about something. A word is always represents the thing or the reality to which for which it stands. And any translation restricts or delimits the nature of what it's attempting to communicate. Therefore, the most perfect kind of knowledge is silent, is wordless, where this translation, this stepping down, doesn't need to be made in the first place. It's an intuitive, if you like, entering into the nature of what I'm contemplating. And for Plato, that, at the end of this long, what he calls, path in the Republic, there lies this intuitive grasp of essences, not an easy one, he says this over and over, but to anyone in love, if you like, with the universe, it'll be the only satisfying aim, because everything else is so partial. Now, perhaps I'll just develop that one last idea and then stop for a while and take questions if you have any, because I don't want to drown you in too much material. Plato has developed, and I've been developing here today, what seems to be a dualistic framework. Two worlds, this one and the other one, the time-bound universe of space and time and the senses and of tangibility, and the other one, the abstract one, the eternal one, the non-created, in a certain sense, eternal universe. And all of us are curious, more than curious, are eager to know what the relationship is between these two. Does Plato devalue the universe in which we live? That's a major question, I think, for anybody who first comes upon Plato. And I think the answer to that is complex, but one can sketch it nonetheless because it has broad outlines. Perhaps the key word to the relationship between the visible, called the sensible world in Plato, and the invisible, the eternal, intelligible world, because it's capable of being understood by us. The key word, perhaps, between the connection between the two is, to me, the word partial. It's not that the world, the sensed, familiar world in which we live, is false or completely unreal. Plato does not say that. He says, however, it's but a tiny hint of what there is. Its beauty is but a fraction of the beauty there is. Its truth is but a limited aspect of the truth of the whole. And its goodness, because it's a term I cannot omit, for Plato, nothing can be understood without the idea of the good. It's his most puzzling idea. Nobody can exactly figure out what he meant, with the result that if you pick up a volume of essays, and there are many good ones floating around these days, by scholars who are working on Plato, you'll find that nobody dares to tackle that concept of the good. They all say it's completely bewildering, and then they go on to something else. What Plato could have meant by the good has been the subject of great conjecture, but it's clear how the good functions. The good, says Plato, is the binding power of the universe. He says that in the Phaedo. Without the notion of the good, and perhaps synonyms for such a term might be the holy, the ultimate, all of them are bad, I must admit, but he calls it the good, so take it as a primitive, undefined terms. Without whatever that is, the divine, the good, nothing can function. That's his view. And nothing can be explained. And he, in the allegory of the cave, he gives a metaphor. The good in the cosmos as a whole, or in the whole realm of being, visible and invisible, is analogous to the place occupied by the sun in our world, in our solar system. Without the sun, nothing can be, because without the sun, there is no life. So the good is the source of being. That's its one function. And secondly, the good is that which makes all entities visible. Without the good, there is no light. There is no vision. So it has a twofold function. Without it, nothing can be known, but more primary than that, without it, nothing can exist. The good is fully evident only in this intuitive realm, if you like, and only fully accessible through higher states of consciousness. But to come back to the relationship between these seemingly disparate worlds, everything, even in our universe, even in our world, has a partial aspect of it, is a partial manifestation of it. The same with truth and the same with beauty. And so you can really evaluate, if you like, the Platonic metaphysics in one of two ways. Either you can say, because he holds out for a higher world, he makes this one seem a bit pale and perhaps boring or uninteresting. That, I think, is a mistake. And it's not my interpretation, and I think Plato is much too eager a mind, too intellectually curious about everything, to warrant or encourage that interpretation. So you can turn it around, and it's an equivalent description, and it would be stating the same thing but in a positive way. Because there is this universe of ideal and pure, timeless essences that govern all the particulars of our sensed world, all those entities in our world, including ourselves, including taking the most trivial thing, cannot help but be touched by and connected to this eternal realm. It mirrors it. It copies it. Plato uses that word. It's an imperfect copy of the eternal essences, and it kind of strives after it. A plant knows what it should be, what it should do, how it should grow, when it should stop growing, because there's the ideal disembodied archetype after which it hungers and which it hopes to realize. And that's what a fully developed plant is all about. So in a certain sense, rather than devaluing our universe, I think Plato divinizes it. He makes it holy, because even the realm of sometimes our trivialities is still the arena of being which mirrors, he calls it the world of becoming, that world of perfection which man strives for. And so the path, if you like, the path of towards self-transformation, ultimately towards sainthood, wisdom, adepthood, which Plato intimates throughout his writings, is perhaps best concretized in the allegory of the cave and the republic, where this sensible world is likened to an underground cave in which we are prisoners, chained by the neck and the feet to face only a wall on which we think we're perceiving realities, when in fact they are but images of shadows, of objects that some puppeteer has projected behind us on a ramp illumined by artificial torchlight. And that is our condition in the untransformed state. Now, a consequence of that, if you like, of esoteric Platonism, is to imbue one's life with a sense of excitement. That sounds paradoxical, but I am willing to stand by that, because it's as if Plato was saying, one of the most marvelous things that anybody can discover on questioning anything at all, and man is the philosophic animal, the questioning animal, all that. One of the most exciting things one can discover is that nothing is what it seems. Everything is different. Everything is more vast, more whole, more beautiful, more truthful, more holy, if you like, than what it seems. And so he turns around the thesis of the sophists, and the thesis that, alas, is propounded, I think, far too much today, that seeing is believing. Plato rejects it and turns it upside down. Seeing is not believing. Seeing is misleading. You have to get way beneath the surface of anything in order to know it. And when you begin to get beneath the surface, you find a whole new world in which nothing is what it seems. What seems stable evaporates. What seems enduring is time-bound. What seems causal is but a consequence of something else, and that of something else, which you have to keep pursuing, he says in the Symposium, until you can go no further, until you abound or come upon this vision of the good. And therefore, if seeing is not believing, and if the world is filled with surprises, I think it becomes an extremely exciting place, which a place which is far more comprehensive than merely, let's say, the scientific search, which can be accommodated in Plato's views, but it goes into the inner domain as well. And it says, not only are things not what they seem, you yourself, man, the searcher, is not what he seems, but he's a more, he's far more. And there is a way to experience that, and people have done it. And those Plato calls the gods that I invoked at the very beginning of this. Now, unfortunately, I don't really have so much more time. Perhaps a few, those of you who want to read a little bit more of this, I would say perhaps if you're interested in Plato's teachings on the path, the two worlds, knowledge versus opinion, his ideas and so on, then you should especially read the Allegory of the Cave in the seventh book of the Republic. It's just a chapter. But that's where the heart of his metaphysics lies, I would say. And in fact, his philosopher king, it's a thought that only came to me a few days ago. I'd never thought about it in that light. The philosopher king is often taken to be a kind of, you know, big brother, tyrant. And I've always argued, no, he's really the head of the yogic society of a given culture, and we need him, and he's not a tyrant, he's benevolent, all that. But I realized, rethinking all this again, this week, in fact, at this lovely library here at Alcott, that one interpretation for the philosopher king that I think can be made to stand is that he's a kind of master or guru. He's what in many contexts one would call a master, who has seen the form, has left the cave, has turned around, realizes what the shadows are, realizes their source, goes up into the light, as the prisoner who wants to know has to do, doesn't just want to feed upon opinion, as Plato says in the Phaedrus. And when he sees the light, the good, the holy, the divine, he understands who he is, where he came from, why he mistakenly took appearance to be reality. And the earmark of every great teacher, master, adept, this notion of selflessness and compassion, goes back down into the cave in Plato's Republic in order to tell others who are very likely to ridicule him anyway. Plato has no illusions about that, ridicule or crucify or something like that, to tell them what things really are. So in the cave, then I think there's a wonderful parable in the Phaedrus where Plato talks about the charioteer and the horses. What is amazing about this metaphor is that you'll find it in the Upanishads, in the Bhagavad Gita, and in Plato. It's everywhere in esoteric literature. It's consistent. The charioteer is the soul, is kind of the guiding principle. And the horses are, one is a ruly and one is unruly. One is the part of us that is attracted, if you like, to the divine in ourselves, and the other are the appetites that sort of want to go their own way. And the charioteer is the mediator. And if he's strong and centered, we would say today, in himself, he can manage. And if he can manage, and this is one of the loveliest metaphors in Plato, then he's able to, after death, get his horses to obey him. And if the horses obey him, they manage to get up to the rim of the heavens. This is obviously metaphorical, so don't take it literally. And at the rim of the heavens, they see the forms. They glimpse the universal essences. Now, if the charioteer is powerful and has control of his horses, he will be in a stable position to see the forms at some length and with some clarity. And therefore, he will not very easily forget them. He will carry that through and be a man, what we would term, of insight in his life or in his next life. But if the horses are unruly, then one will pull one way and one will pull the other. And Plato has the figure sort of bob up and down. And just as the forms come up, the horse is down and you've missed the boat. And so someone like that has not seen the absolutes very well and is to use his own language, is likely to forget the mysteries which he once beheld and is going to need some more work in his next life in order to re-evoke this. In the symposium, you really should look at the ladder of love, which is this cosmic eros that holds everything together and that relates the physical to the abstract, relates the whole, the two worlds, if you like, that I've been talking about, and unifies them into one, because what girds them is love. And what love is for Plato is the drive for union, not just, as we tend to think in the restricted sense, sexual union, but for cosmic union. Because we move on this ladder of love, we fall in love, and that's the easiest way to fall in love. We've all gone through that. With one beautiful form. And then we realize that there's a common denominator between forms, between beauty, and we begin to widen our vision away from the partial towards the larger. And we see beauty in many forms. And finally, we see beauty not just physically, but with a mind's eye. And from there, we widen our view still, and we see beauty in abstract terms, and finally beauty in institutions, and then beauty in the arts, and finally in sciences, which are, after all, ultimate principles of what make things work in our world. And lastly, says Plato, and he uses the word suddenly, there's a leap, if you like, on the seventh step of the ladder of love in the symposium. Suddenly we see beauty herself, and of that he cannot speak, and he doesn't speak. He simply says you have to experience it. But it's bliss. It's bliss. It's the thing that the Indians call ananda, bliss. It's fulfillment. And so love, viewed in that light, is a titanic force. It's nothing on or off or trivial, but a link between the soul and the universe as a whole. I've talked about the myth of Ur in the 10th book of the Republic, where karma, reincarnation, order, rhythm in the universe is stressed. And one dialogue, which I won't have time at all to touch on, but it's perhaps the most intriguing because so esoteric and so crammed full of rich notions, is the Timaeus, where he talks about creation of the world, the idea of the demiurge, divine demiurge, who creates everything according to divine ideation into space itself. And he talks of gods, we would call them logi, who are multiple in form, not just one. Divinities, the whole world is divine. I think I've talked about that. The universe has a soul. It's breathing. It's alive. It's not just a stage in which we, who are the only breathing and alive creatures, are set, can move. But no, we are a mirror of the universe as a whole. And just as we breathe and sleep and wake and have rhythm, so does the whole universe. And finally, in the Phaedo, I think you find the arguments about the immortality of the soul and the, what I call, puzzling, intriguing idea of philosophy as the practice of the art of death and dying. Well, I could go on really for days and for hours, and I wouldn't mind doing so, but I have mercy upon all of you who have to trudge back. So I'll stop now, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.